Magic Book Club with Bensons for Beds.
Welcome to the Magic Book Club podcast, the podcast where we find out exactly what makes our favourite authors put pen to paper. Or, you know, fingers to keyboard, each to their own. On this episode, we have quite the romance special. First up, we'll be joined by reality TV sweetheart and Queen of the Jungle from 2017, Georgia Tofolo, to talk all about her brand new book, Meet Me in Hawaii. I have a bone to pick with her about some steamy scenes. Ooh. And a little bit later on, we'll be chatting with debut author Megan Nolan, hot off the press from her first release, The Utterly Brilliant Acts of Desperation. So sit back, pour yourself a cuppa, spark up that treadmill in the garage as we find out just what makes these authors tick. And off we go. Well, first up, we are joined by Sunday Times bestseller Queen of the Jungle from 2017, looking a whole lot cleaner than she was at the end of your 7 weeks or however long it is in the jungle. Blimey, it's such a long time, isn't it? The gorgeous Georgia Tofolo. How are you, my dear?
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be here. Gosh, what a lovely thing to say about me. Thank you so much.
Now, listen, how are you and how has this second lockdown been? I'm judging by the fact that we're talking about your new book, that it has been fairly productive.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, we started working on the books about 2.5 years ago. And because Meet Me in Hawaii is the second of four, which is completely mind-blowing for me. But I spent the first lockdown finishing Meet Me in Hawaii. So in a way, the world turned upside down, but I was really able to get productive because I'm a bit naughty. I get distracted very easily. So the fact that all the pubs and everything was shut played right in my favour. But no, it's just been amazing. And also, just I'm such a lover of literature, just outside of obviously my books. And it's been amazing for me to hear. There's some wonderful statistics that romance fiction has sold better than it ever has done. And it's music to my ears that people are turning to books for respite that we all need. So yeah, it's been a really bizarre year, but a really wonderful one. With my first book came out last October. And as you said, a Sunday Times bestseller, which makes me die inside every time I hear it. But no, it's just been a really, really, it's been a bizarre year, but a special year for me.
Well, congratulations. Well done. I mean, you know, that to launch yourself as an author and do so well, it takes some doing. So congratulations. We know this much about you, that you are a keen bookworm and that you love to read. However, has this desire to write always been sort of niggling away in the back of your head? Because you've done so much and you've trained and you've got a legal brain and you're a sportswoman and all these kind of things. And in between all that, has it always been just ticking away going, at some point I'm going to do this?
Yeah, so you put it more eloquently than I ever have done. That's exactly it. I mean, I started writing when I was probably 13, 14, but filing it all away. It was always just my thing. And I did English A-level and I absolutely love it. And when I started doing television when I was kind of 18, 19, I was really young. Writing was just my private thing. And I also, it's not like that imposter syndrome, but I think it's normal for people to underestimate yourself.
And yes, especially women. We do it all the time.
I can't help it. And yeah. For years, I mean, I did The Jungle, as you said, in 2017. It was a really crazy time for me, emotionally quite tough, because I went from, you know, Made in Chelsea, where I was kind of a bit character, no one really bothered about Toph. And I was then sprung into this crazy world of, you know, with millions of followers and lots of people wanting to talk to me. And for me, writing was my escape. But I then went to this book launch of a friend of mine, and there was a lady who was very high up at Mills and Boone there. And I went to the loo and I just thought, if you don't take this chance now, you're never, ever going to be this close to anyone that is so important in literature ever again, particularly when, you know, romantic fiction is my bread and butter. But of course, no one had ever read anything that I've written. And she said, well, why don't you come in for a meeting? And it went on and on and on. And then there was this wonderful idea. So Mills and Boone is owned by HarperCollins.
Yeah.
And they have this special thing where they pair people up with a co-author. And that was just a game changer for me, because I started kind of flexing my writing muscles a little bit and sending it to, I've co-written it with four different amazing women. And the first lady was like, you can actually write. And I was like, oh no, I don't think I can. It's all a load of rubbish.
And she does.
Editing my stuff, and that was actually how the first book, Meet Me in London, started. So yeah, I couldn't have done it without the co-authors, But how amazing for me that I've had an experience working alongside super successful women. I mean, I hope that we've created something really special.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And I just wonder as well, because it, sometimes, you know, when you're sort of clearing out the loft, like we've all done during lockdown, and I've discovered school books that my mum had kept of stories. Do you ever go back and read some of those stories that you wrote when you were 13 and 14?
Yeah, it's so funny you say that. So my mum found, it was I think I was only about 14, and it was my English book, but at the back, yeah. I turned it over and I was writing all these stories. So I was obviously not doing what I was meant to be doing. And mum sent it up to me last year and she was like, "You've always been able to write." I was like, "Oh God, mum, so cringe." Mums are just like that.
Totally proud, exactly. I'm going to keep the story where you tell it. Will you tell everybody about going to the farm and what you did at the weekend?
Yeah, but there is something so special. I'm quite traditional and I write to all of my friends and I'm a real sucker for a thank you note and they go on for pages and pages. But the paper trail, I just hope that we will keep and cherish because, you know, so many things are online.
Yeah.
I just think there's something really special about actually holding something tangible.
Absolutely.
And I date everything as well. Dating things is really important because you always forget when you wrote something, always.
Well, it's increasingly difficult to remember when you did everything because anything during lockdown, because you always remember things in the context of other stuff. And when there's nothing going on, you look back and go, "I've no idea when I did that." Literally no idea.
Have you felt that the time is whizzing by so quickly, which yes. I'm thrilled about because I'm just dying to go and, you know, have a bit of fun now. But I've just, the weeks are whizzing and it's amazing.
It is indeed. It is. It is. Now, listen, I want to talk to you about why romance novels. You sort of briefly skimmed over it there that, you know, you were obviously, you knew about Mills and Boone and we've never met. I don't know you personally, but what I know about you is that there's, you know, there is this huge imagination, this great use of words, and you are quite a romantic type of individual. Was that a no-brainer that it was always going to be romance novels?
I think it had to be because, well, I mentioned I wasn't as confident as I would have liked to have been. And because my outlet has always been reading romantic fiction, I think my first venture into that world had to be that. And I think perhaps the other thing, I made a decision a few years ago to, quite a tricky one, because I'm quite an open, public person. Like, I'm not shy.
No, you're not.
I'm really not. And I love sharing every detail of my life with everyone. And I have done since I was 18. So I had to kind of take a step back and think about, you know, how that might affect the people around me. And I made quite a hard decision to not speak about my public romances. It was about 2.5-3 years ago.
Yes.
And I really wanted to protect myself because, you know, stuff happens that you don't want to happen, like you get dumped or someone cheats on you. And I could not imagine myself for, I hope I do what I do forever. And yeah. I think, for me to be able to do that and feel emotionally equipped to do that, I had to keep something back. So I wonder whether these books that are just full to the brim of love and there's a bit of sex in them as well, just a little.
We will come on to that in a minute, young lady.
Yes, bit naughty, but they're not, you know, too naughty. But I wonder whether I have used these books to kind of broadcast to people that love is amazing and I love, even though I don't shout from rooftops about it. But to be honest, I want to.
The thing is when you speak about it like that, it is of no surprise at all that romantic fiction has flown during lockdown because we all need that escapism. I don't want to read. I have picked up several books where I've just gone, "Oh, I can't do this now.
Nothing too heavy.
I just need to get on with it and have a little bit of fun with it." And it is escapism. And I mean, Meet Me in London, obviously based in the capital, and Hawaii, we've got beaches and sunshine and waves and chirping frogs.
All of that.
Have you been to Hawaii?
No, I'm dying to go. This is why it had to be in Hawaii, because I didn't take a gap year and I didn't travel. And because I've just been working the whole time, which really is an amazing thing, I never got to go to Hawaii. So it was top of the list. But we have also been incredibly lucky that I think so many people, I know I am, I'm dying to go away.
Yes.
And, you know, Meet Me in Hawaii is armchair travel. So, you know, it's been a wonderful coincidence that, you know, Boris hasn't allowed us to travel and the book's coming out.
You're going to lose your mind when you actually are on a beach in Hawaii and you hear those frogs. You're going to be like,
yeah, I'm saying this. I know. I keep on saying it. Can you imagine the feeling of me leaving that airport? Yes. And I mean, we have been working this book for over a year. And I mean, I feel like I know Hawaii like back of my hand. I mean, Google Earth is my friend. But that feeling, if I was to ever get there, which I know I will this year, I really, really pray, leaving the airport and hearing the sounds and smelling the smells that I've written about in the book, be really special.
Tell me about Mali then. Where did she come from? Because even though that there is this beautiful language and romantic descriptive language, there are some lines that she delivers in very typical Georgia way. Shut that down. Stop being daft. Get on with it.
It had to be so because... So just a quick top line. So the four books all centralise on a different girlie. So there are four girls who are best friends from Devon, like me. And each book centralises in one of them. So the first one was Victoria. The second one, as you say, is Mali. And I really wanted it to come across right from the first chapter that Mali is quite small and mighty, which I really love. And I wanted to also dispel any silly myths that Mills and Boone was sort of a fantasy where men make women happy. And it was all, I just wanted to challenge it because that isn't the case. But I really wanted to set the record straight. So the first chapter, Mali saves a chap from drowning. Now, it's normally the other way around, isn't it? So I thought, let's just set the tone straight away. And she actually, it isn't the kind of stereotypical fairy tale because Mali thinks and feels so strongly that she's so independent that fine, this gorgeous, handsome man has come in front of her and wanted to whisk her off her feet, but she's resisted. She's like, I've got my thing going on. She runs a surf school and she's just so, she's aesthetically very beautiful, but inside she's got some morals that I think are really, really special and lots of people should have. But I love that we were able to really write throughout the whole book that she basically told him to do the whole way through, which I love.
It's not easy for her to resist his wily charms, though. It isn't easy for her. I'm thinking as well, we know you played a lot of tennis as a kid growing up in Devon. Did you surf?
No, this is the thing, but I know the reason why I felt so strongly about it is because I have projected a lot of characteristics and talents into my girls that I just don't possess. And I know that I've done it subconsciously because I went to school. So I grew up on the south coast of Devon in Torbay, but I went to school in mid Devon and a really good friend of mine owns a surf school on the north coast. And every time I would go and stay with him, I would look at all of these gorgeous girlies and blokes getting in the water. Now, if anyone has gone for a dip in North Devon, it's so cold. And I am such a snowflake. I was just like, I'm having none of it. But I think I've just soaked all of it up and thought, how amazing that they do get in and do that. Whereas I just sure with, you know, an ice cream and a bacon sarnie and that's me done, you know.
You know, I didn't. We have something in common. Mm. We have both danced in timepiece.
Oh my god, you're a timepiece legend. I can't believe you are a timepiece legend. Wow.
I'm a timepiece legend. I was, because I went to university in Exeter, so we used to go to timepiece. I was like, oh my gosh, yes, we both danced in timepiece.
Darling, there is something that I wonder that the university students do miss out on, and it's Christmas timepiece. You know, it snows in there, it snows in the nightclub.
I have heard, but I have never experienced Christmas in timepiece.
I haven't thought about timepiece enough recently. I think timepiece might have to be the first night out I go to because not only is it the best dance floor in the whole of the UK, you can go downstairs and get a burger afterwards. So you don't even have to go to a burger van, it's just downstairs.
It's so cool. Now, listen, we're talking to you sitting at a desk. Is it the desk that you write at? Because we always like to find out about our authors and how they write and what you need around you in order to be as creative as you are. Set the scene. So, how do you write?
I would like to say that I love sitting in a really chic coffee shop in Chelsea and like all of that. If there is anyone around me, I am like a naughty little fly. I'm like, oh, what's that? What are you talking about? Has to be dead silent. The dog has to even be asleep because he is the biggest distraction. Yes. And I sit here and I hammer it out. And it's a strange thing. I like being very warm when I'm doing my writing. So I've got a little fan here. I always have my little fan on. I don't know why, I hate being cold. So whenever I'm really having a big writing day, my structure is very, because I've got so many different things going on. When we're close to deadline, I'm not going to lie and say I do it every day, but when the deadline's looming, I get up really early. I'm a bit of an early bird, so I'll do 7 until 10.
Okay.
And then I'll get on with my other bits. But no, I've always liked the idea of being some chic woman who saunters around with her map. Book, and it's just not me. I have to plant myself at home.
Now listen, I want to have a chat about, because there is some steam in these books. There are some incredible kisses in these books. So I guess the next question is akin to asking actors about the intimate scenes that they write, that they act. When you are writing intimate, come on now, we're all girls, I won't tell anybody. When, and can I thank you? I'm a woman of a certain age, and my love life, Georgia, is not what it used to be in the first throes of when in my mid-20s.
Blame it on the pandemic, darling.
So quite literally, it's been a pleasure. So tell me what goes through your mind. Do you have to go and have a cold shower afterwards? Do you have to plan these out? Do you have to reenact them with a pillow? How do you write the difficult, steamy scenes? They're brilliant, by the way.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. I'm going to be really honest with you. As a Mills and Boone author, I probably should say that they flow really freely.
Yes.
I don't. Now, I'm not a prude. I'm kind of the opposite, but putting pen to paper about it, it's a slow process. And yes. I have giggles every time. I have had numerous meetings about what you call the you-know-what. And it's just one of those things that you have to just do it bit by bit. But the problem is, when you write something and you reference it back, you're like, oh God, that is so cringe. Like, I can't. And then I read it back and I'm like, no, that's what I would like to read in a sexy. I mean, there's no like proper bonking in there. It's like, you know, it's not heavy.
You are so old school. That's the first time I've heard that word, bonking, for ages. I love a good bonk.
But no, I struggle with it ever so slightly. But it's so important that we do, because the sexual tension throughout my books, it goes on so much and it reaches this massive crescendo. And it would be a travesty if we didn't have a bit of it in there.
Oh my goodness me,
but
of course.
It's just the thought of like my grandmother reading it or like my mum. It's just a bit, but I'm sure they absolutely will love it, but it's not addressed.
I think they get to the crashing waves and know what's coming and maybe so we'll skip that chapter. And during COVID too, this could be one of the first Zoom novels. Do you see this? Do you see these on the screen? Because they are very... there's some really dramatic landscapes and the plots are just lend themselves so easily to TV and the big screen.
Now, of course, I will always play my own trumpet and be like, my book needs to be made into a film, of course. I mean, wouldn't that be the dream?
Yes.
I always think that, because Todd is quite, he's not the stereotypical hero. He's very handsome, but he's quite vampy. And I think, you know, the juxtaposition of him, the Brit, the South Londoner being in Hawaii, is just quite fun and he's really pale. And I always picture him as like Robert Pattinson, you know, like vampire vibes. And I always think about Mally because she's just, you need someone who's so beautiful inside and out. And I think the values of whoever could play her really have to align with her as a person. But also they've got to learn how to surf or know how to surf. So
who do we know that surfs?
I was thinking Margot Robbie because she's Australian, but that might be real, you know, when you put everyone with the same brush. She might never have been surfing. She might just be a Nazi.
it's worth a phone call, babe. It's worth a phone call for sure.
Well, apparently she used to live in... she used to live in a house share in Clapham. And
okay.
Have you heard of Bunga Bunga? It's just like karaoke yes. place. It's classic. My friends and I were in there. Apparently she was in there on the same night. So I probably should have approached her. But how amazing is that? Like, what A-list celebrity lives in a house share in Clapham? And that goes to the same places as I do and sings like really bad karaoke. Like, what a legend. That's subconsciously obviously what I put in the back of my mind. That's why I want her to play her.
I think this is easily done. I think this is easily done. Listen, so we've got Meet Me in Hawaii. We've had Meet Me in London. The two others, can we know what they are called?
Yeah.
Are you allowed?
So I can tell you the third book. So it's Meet Me in Tahiti. We go off to Tahiti, which is pretty exciting. And I was so thrilled that we were able to shoehorn the first two chapters of Tahiti into the back of Meet Me in Hawaii. So the story continues a bit. And then the last book I'm not allowed to say, but all I can say, what can I say? We're going home. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's quite a big clue.
Meet me on the beach in Devon.
I'm not telling you.
Meet me in Torbay.
Imagine. God, my mother would be thrilled. God, meet me in Torbay.
Listen, you're a joy as always. It's lovely to speak to you. Thank you for your book and making me smile. You take care. All the best. It's lovely to speak to you.
Thank you, darling.
Take care, baby. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It really is a fantastic bit of armchair travel. Meet Me in Hawaii is out now. Joining us now is a fabulous young writer and a brilliant mind behind the acclaimed new novel, Acts of Desperation. It's Megan Nolan. Megan, great to have you on the Magic Book Club podcast. How are you? Are you feeling the positive vibes of a positive 2021?
I am, yeah. It was all quite hard to take in while it was happening the week of publication. And I was so busy trying to get, all the interviews and little bits and bobs done that I couldn't quite absorb how great it all was. And then last week and the week before, I had time to just sit back and read everything. And it's been an amazing feeling. Obviously, it was such a long time coming that I was working on the book. So it's an incredible feeling.
Talking of which, Sarah Jessica Parker has your Acts of Desperation.
I was just saying to my mum last night, because we used to watch it together when I was a teenager, and I was just thinking, oh my god, if I could tell 15-year-old Megan that this has happened, she would be screaming so hard.
15-year-old Megan Carrie Bradshaw is reading your book. It's so cool. I was very jealous of that. I was like, that's a moment. That's definitely a moment. In this time then, the last year, where everybody has had a real time to kind of be a little bit more introverted, a little bit more inward looking, releasing something so personal like a debut novel and a novel of this kind, which is challenging and passionate and desperate. How did that feel to you when you let it go, when you let your baby out into this strange world that we find ourselves in at the moment?
Yeah, it was the timeline was a bit funny actually, because I only ended up doing the final edits and adding in some scenes that ended up in the book while in the first lockdown in Ireland, because I'd been in New York I was meant to be there for a couple of months just seeing friends and hanging out with people and doing some work, and then COVID started, so I flew home to Ireland, and that's where I finished off the last edits of the book and added in some new scenes as well. So that was sort of a funny feeling. It was good in a way, because while I was in New York, I was thinking, oh my god, it's so much fun here, I'm having the best social life ever, so I can't really imagine I'm going to sit down and finish this book maybe. So yeah, I had that in the first lockdown to concentrate on, and then since then I've been really unproductive, so it's been really great to have the book in the background, you know, as some sort of solid proof that I have ever done some work. That was good. Yeah, exactly.
I have to say as well, and you know, we just mentioned it there, it's been received with great praise. It really has. The Guardian's called it a fierce novel of obsessive love. The Evening Standard says you have a disarmingly distinctive voice. Lots of comparisons to Sally Rooney's work, which has got to be a good thing. I often ask this if I'm interviewing pop stars, musicians. Was there a moment when you were writing for them a song, or for you this book, that you kind of go, you know, I think this is quite good?
No, not at all. No. No, I've really relied on my agent Harriet. She's a really good friend of mine, because she was with me the whole process, and I just have no distance from my own work at all. And if I had been left to my own devices, I honestly would not have finished it, and I would have thrown away anything that I had produced, because I had such little confidence in it while it was being put together. And then even when we finished it, I mean, I thought it was probably good, but I didn't really know, you know, the whims of the industry. You have no idea. So I just had no, I really had no clue. I thought maybe it would end up getting published by, say, like a very, very small press, or maybe like with an art gallery or something like that. But no, I was totally taken aback by everything that happened.
And are you the type of person where that praise sits easily and you can sort of appreciate your work, or do you kind of fight it a little bit and go, no, not me, really?
I'm trying to get better at accepting it. My dad is very concerned with like making sure that I try and hear it fully. So like if I'm having a bad day, or there is a bad review, or there's some negative comment or whatever, he'll always just send me a sort of, you know, bombard me with every good thing that's ever been said about it in one go.
Nice dad.
He's a great dad, yeah. But yeah, I think I definitely have the thing that a lot of people, and especially, you know, neurotic, anxious people who create things for the public have, which is that you can just sort of skim over 100 really nice comments, then you see one and that ruins your day then, which I'm trying to get past, but it's a hard one.
Oh my goodness me, I'm exactly the same. It just takes one little text to come in from a listener to say,
yeah, I bet.
Or totally SHIT, get off my airwaves. And I'm like, that's it, my life is ruined.
That may explain the next question, actually. So we were chatting to, it's a bit of a romance special podcast this this month, and we were chatting to Georgia Toffolo, who wrote she writes a very hopeful, sparkly Mills and Boone version of romance. Yeah. What you've just said may explain what drew you to very much at the other end of the spectrum, a much more explosive and raw version of love. And sometimes, well, for our protagonist in Acts of Desperation, it's obsessive and dangerous love.
Yes. I think the reason that I was drawn to it was that it's not that I'd only had negative experiences with love. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, like for a lot of my teenage years and some of my early 20s, I had really wonderful boyfriends and really, you know, just unique, magical relationships that I still think about really fondly now. But I think maybe almost as a result of having those formative, really positive experiences, I just sort of prioritized relationships and romance in my life to a really extreme degree, I think, where everything else only mattered, you know, secondarily to the relationship I was in, including my work, my friends, where I was living, everything really. And I think that impulse did lead me into then in my later 20s or in my kind of early to mid 20s into bad situations where I was accepting a lot of less than ideal behavior and putting myself into situations that I really didn't need to be in. And it was from that sort of experience that I was drawing on for Acts of Desperation.
It's interesting because you talk about that impulse, and I wonder whether or not you've had conversations in your head about that for women, very much our impulse is to look outward for confirmation from wherever. It's something that we just do automatically, and you know, you carry that to its natural conclusion, and you very much get to where the young lady is in your book gets to.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, I mean, it definitely doesn't, as you say, it doesn't come naturally to us to draw on our own resources. And we're not really taught to do that, I don't think. You know, we're taught from a very young age that, way before we're sexual or even have crushes, that we're looked at and that we're, you know, that we're of value if we're providing a pleasant appearance to people and, you know, a sort of benign demeanor to people. So I think having absorbed that for most of your life, it's not an easy switch, even when you logically realize that it's not a wise tactic to get your self-worth from outside. I think I would have known that and been able to say it clearly to you in my early 20s when I still was behaving this way. But it's obviously just not something that comes intuitively to you. I think that's a lot of what I was sort of processing myself. Even as I was writing the novel, I was kind of coming out of that. Those sorts of situations, and I think writing the novel was one way for me to sort of put down an extreme version of the feelings I had been having and play them out to their full conclusion.
It was really interesting because I think sort of halfway through when she moves in with Kieran for the first time, and there's that sort of meandering thought process of how did we work out that I was going to cook and you were going to do that, and whilst the vast majority of us thankfully don't find ourselves in the situation that your protagonist does, I mean, that's every woman that's kind of just gone, hang on a minute, why am I doing, and particularly in lockdown where women have felt, you know, they've really felt the harsh end of lockdown in terms of childcare and provision and keeping things going and the family and the frontline workers. And, you know, it's that, how have I, and that really rang a bell with me. It really rang a bell.
I don't know how people do it, because when I have lived with a partner, it was when we had no real responsibilities outside of each other. So even though, you know, those things did crop up, it was more or less manageable. I can't understand how people deal with that dynamic when they also have children and really hardcore careers to work with as well. I saw something on Twitter the other day where a woman had as an experiment, had stopped cleaning up to see what would happen. And everything for days on end, you know, I think it was like 5 days before before her family had begun to clean up for her, for themselves, I should say, not for her. And I just thought, oh my God, my tolerance has gotten so low now because I've lived alone for a while that I don't know how I would respond to that.
It's really funny. There is, I'm reading Glennon Doyle's Untamed at the moment, and this is like the kind of, you know, the sort of therapy version of Acts of Desperation.
Right.
And she said, and she mentions that, you know, there's this extract where her wife goes out and leaves the husband in charge for the day and leaves him a list of things to do. And she says, well, hang on a minute. Like, when did we get to that point? When did we get to that point that this grown man can't do that themselves? Anyway, that's another conversation. Let's get to your protagonist, because your protagonist with no name, which is hugely significant. There are some really high emotional stakes that we've mentioned. She has some terrible ordeals, some of which I'm sure could have been avoided, some of which she seeks, some of which she can't help. But they're very difficult scenes, and it culminates in a very violent sexual scene. That I can't imagine that was lightly approached.
No, I didn't quite know that it would end in that way when I began it, because I had actually, so the way that I wrote the book was that I actually wrote the very final the sort of final section, which is set in Athens, I had written first before anything else, and then I worked backwards from there. You know, I went back to the start and began there, but I knew that it had to end in some way that wasn't just a normal breakup, and it had to be something scarring for her to force her out of this need of hers to be in relationships like that.
Yeah.
So I knew something needed to happen, but then that just sort of came up organically as I was working. But yeah, no, it wasn't easy. It was, you know, when you're writing these things, and it's not that I think they don't have any value, but when you're writing something ugly, it's an ugly feeling as well to be creating it. So, you don't step away from the desk feeling great after writing that, you know what I mean? Even apart from your own emotions, it's also just a bit, ambivalent for me to put something ugly into the world, you know?
Yeah, completely. I wanted to know, do you have to, it's like, I'm sure it happens with actors all the time, when actors do difficult scenes together, they sort of have to emotionally de-rig. There must be such a sense of responsibility, you know, coming away from a scene like that, personally, you know, sort of finding your balance again and being responsible for sending that out into the world.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. Someone asked me at an event just after the launch lately, what I thought about trigger warnings for novels. And genuinely, I'd never ever thought of it before.
Wow.
And it just, you know, it's not something I had a stance on. It's not even something I necessarily have a stance on now. Although we did have kind of an interesting conversation where, because it's not that I think it's wrong to do that. It's just that I wouldn't want it. And you know, for my, as in as a reader, I wouldn't want it. My personal traumas or ordeals or whatever you want to call them, I don't happen to experience culture in that way where I need those warnings, but I want other people to have them. So we had this conversation about the possibility of maybe having like a designated place in the jacket where they would be if you wanted to look for them. We just had this quite a good discussion about it, and it did make me think about my own book, because to be honest with you, given that we didn't have any book deal while I was writing it, I really was not thinking about the anticipated response to it, which was good because it let me write those things, you know, in a way that wasn't too cautious. But it did mean that when it was being sent out, as in, you know, once it had been published into a proof and people were really reading it, that was the moment where I thought, oh my God, I hope I don't really, you know, ruin someone's day with some of the things in this book.
It's Megan, honestly, I think your language, your use of language, the way it's written is so unbelievably refreshing that even with the difficult scenes, the difficult chapters, it's masterfully delivered, and it's been such a delight to read. And you know, really, I mean, you know, I wouldn't expect to say a delight, but you know, because it is. So I'm going to ask a little bit about your writing, because You know, this is a debut novel, but you're no stranger to writing. You've written for the New York Times, The Guardian. Have you always been writing stories? Have you always been writing opinion, or was fiction there as a kid for you?
Yeah, I'd always been writing stories, and actually poetry was my main thing for a long time. When I was a child and teenager and young adult, it was mainly poetry that I was focused on, but also some fictional stories. The journalism stuff kind of came because I moved to Dublin when I was 18, and I knew I wanted to have something to do with writing, but obviously, you know, there's no like obvious in to poetry and fiction as an 18-year-old with no real backing, or whatever you want to call it. But so there was one of these like free sheet event guides.
I just
started to do film reviews for them, and that was sort of the first journalistic thing I did. But it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't a big dream of mine to be a journalist whatsoever. It wasn't really something I saw as a career you could make money from. Like when I was doing it, it was just something in my very much my spare time as a teenager in Dublin. But I think so to answer your question, sorry, I did write for most of my life, but I had quite a weird gap then when I did go to Dublin and some things sort of went off the rails for me, and I didn't really write in any serious way for a couple of years then. And by the time I started back, I was starting to play with the essay form that I sort of continue with to this day.
Of course, we have to say as well, because of the comparisons to Sally Rooney and the success of her TV adaptation, Normal People, is it a little germ of hope that this might make the small screen? Have you got any, you know, have you thought about this making the small screen or the big screen even?
No, I mean, I don't. In the way to do with what we talked about earlier, in a sort of self-protective way, I don't really ever like try and think about something good that might happen to me until it starts happening. So like, well, I'm very grateful because everyone that, you know, works at the agency that I'm signed to is very dynamic and, you know, clever, and they'll do anything that they can do in that regard. So I'll let them at it and, you know, talk to them if it happens. But for the moment, I'm happy, you know.
One step at a time, hey.
Yeah.
Listen, whatever. I mean, and that kind of answers the question, which was, is there anything in the pipeline that you can tell us about? But for the minute, I'm really enjoying this book. It's absolutely fantastic. So whatever comes next from you, I'm sure it will be amazing.
Yeah, there's a second novel. So when I signed to Jonathan Cape, it was for two books. So I'm in the middle of working on that one at the moment, and I will be for the next couple of months, or maybe the rest of the year. So yeah, that will be it's a very different sort of enterprise than Act of Desperation, because it's, you know, with Act, it's all one interior monologue, it's one person's perspective. So even just getting out of that format, it's been really fun, actually, because it's a new way of writing for me. So I've been enjoying it a lot.
Megan, and of course, a real toast to Dublin as well. And there's so much of Dublin's character in the book as well. I'm sure it must have been really, really nice for you to be able to put that in there. It's lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on the Book Club podcast. I really enjoyed it. Absolutely fantastic. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure to be on. Thank you.
It's absolutely an astonishing read. It really is. And that, sadly, is all we've got time for on the Magic Book Club podcast. Join us next time for more fantastic books. In the meantime, head to magic.co.uk to see the rest of our picks and join the club. And of course, happy reading.